ownership. On the other hand, they may feel very comfortable with that decision. Then you can write the way up here, increasing level of involvement, increasing ownership, and for example, we may say we're going to delegate something to a group of people we trust and they can get on and do it. It could be the students making a decision how they want to run an event. It could be a parent committee deciding how they want to run part of graduation, although not all graduation is open for discussion. It could be a group of teachers who want to decide how they do assessments at the end of a unit. So there's that delegation. So you've got this continuum of involvement. And I think the big question is, often, is why wasn't I involved? Or why was I left out? And there's a whole group of reasons why that could be the case. For example, it could be a time constraint, it's a rushed decision. It could be that the level of expertise involved in a decision is such that you don't want to open it up to a wide range of people for involvement because you want to make sure that only experts are involved in that decision. You could also decide that, you know, the amount of stakeholder buy-in can be very, very important for some decisions. And to come back to probably the impetus for this question, the late start discussion. So there's been a discussion recently about late starts, and I think there's a certain amount of feeling that people weren't involved or were involved, and how did that process roll out? So just to talk a little bit about that particular decision-making process, late starts were put on the agenda probably 2 years ago. At least 2 years ago, late starts came onto the agenda because of people with a level of expertise saying that the adolescent brain and all those scientific arguments, so that put it on the agenda about 2 years ago. There were discussions, probably informal discussions, going around at least 2 years ago. There was a survey. When was the first survey, Phil? The
survey was
This
year. It was the big survey this year.
February, March. So there was a survey in February, March. Then at the start of this school year, the board of directors made a very specific request to the head of school that he investigates fully. There'd been this conversation going on, but there was a director from the board of directors, the board of trustees, saying to the head of school, please can you investigate the feasibility of late starts? And also part of that was, can you create a rationale? Can you communicate to the community a rationale for why this would be a good idea? So we've had a process which has involved several committees and discussions, involvement with the community, was the opinion was collected from the community. A second survey was collected. When was that, Phil?
That was straight after the pilot, which was in November.
So November. So on the one hand, there's a feeling that there's been a lot of consultation. People have been given information. People have been... Graham Scott sent out information to the community and articles to read about late starts last year. We've run two pilots actually. The point of the pilots was never to question the rationale of the late start initiative. The rationale for the late start initiative is something we feel very convinced. The theory, the science behind it is not up for negotiation. We think that it's been proven. It's been proven in large state systems. We haven't been looking at the rationale. We've been looking more at the logistics and the practicalities of having a late start at ISB. So that's why we ran pilot. We ran a very quick logistical pilot last month. And then during summer school, we ran a pilot with the busing again. During the summer school program, we changed a lot of our buses around for a week at a time, then the second week at a time, manipulating that. Parents gave feedback via forms. There was after those pilots, and then the committee who were looking at late starts met, and they went to the board a few weeks ago and made some recommendations to the board based upon their work, and the board approved those recommendations. So in terms of mechanism and how people were involved, that's a good example of something the school would probably say there was quite a high degree of involvement. However, I would say the school became involved that certain communities felt left out of that discussion. And I think looking back, the school would probably say one of the big mistakes we made was, for example, a lot of the rationale and discussion that we shared with people, well, no, all of it was in English. And there was a certain sort of reflection afterwards, which was we would have been much better served if we'd perhaps had some, because this is such an important conversation, we'd be much better served if some of our communications had been in other languages, which represented some of the big stakeholder groups better. We did listen very carefully to the big stakeholder groups, and really, if you lived outside of Nitschede, your level of anxiety was significantly increased, and certain communities are actually dominant outside of Nitschede. So again, we listened very carefully to those communities. And the decision that the committee made in terms of a recommendation was taken to the board was that this was not the right time to push ahead with this such an initiative when there was so much anxiety and not enough buy-in from a significant stakeholder group. It wasn't abandoned because we're not abandoning it because the rationale and our thinking about the benefits of late starts hasn't gone away. It was purely a logistical hold on this particular initiative. So I've done a lot of talking, and I've addressed what I think was, I've given you a little bit of background. You may say, I don't really care about the background, it was only the late starts we care about, but I'm just trying to give you a little bit of an idea of the complexity of decision making, and that particular decision became quite a heated decision for some people, which is apparent. It never came to me directly. I had one conversation with one person in this room who told me very clearly that there was a, and that, again, that feedback was very important. That face-to-face feedback was very important for me to be able to communicate to people I work with. You know, I think we're missing some buy-in. I think we're missing some stakeholders, or there are some stakeholders who feel whatever we've done, they haven't been heard. And again, that's a common mistake, I think. The biggest mistake when you communicate is thinking you communicated. And I think we thought we communicated, but some certain stakeholders definitely felt we hadn't. What's the question?
No, so there's no late start, because I didn't ever hear a final decision. I know I turned in the
questionnaire
and turned it in, and then
haven't
heard
anything. You're saying we haven't communicated properly?
Yeah. did I totally miss that?
Here's an interesting thing. The person standing in front of you is taking a lot of the heat for the late starts. This actually wasn't my initiative at all. That's not to say that I don't have an opinion on it. I wasn't running the committee. Somebody else in this room was very much the leader of that committee, and they did a great job on it. I'm not looking at you, Mr. Rogers. Mr. Rogers was doing that on behalf of the head of school, who was doing it on behalf of the board. The board has said to the head of school, we want you to investigate this. The head of school chose our brightest and best. Then I couldn't do it, so I said no. So that's the way that rolled out. But we still got people who don't know a really critical part of it. And it's embarrassing to stand here hearing that.
That's my
No, it probably isn't.
But there's also a lot of communication that goes out, and sometimes that does get lost in that sort of sense. So it's no one's fault out there. There was a lot of discussion about it. There were a lot of places where we were considering many different aspects, and there is going to be a difference of opinions across different groups. There's certain groups that are not here today because they live downtown, because they didn't want to travel through the traffic today, because we live in different parts of Bangkok as well. And unfortunately, the current transport system in Bangkok is not as, how to say, efficient as some of the countries that we might come from.
And that's changing. That's changing, and we'll come back to it. And the next time we come back to this, we know there are certain stakeholder groups we'll go to very much more proactively. Do you have a question, sorry?
I just wonder which part of the world, or is it all over the world, they have found out that the data of starting late. Is it only one part of the world?
A lot of the research comes from North America, and where whole school districts have made this decision. You can draw a graph, it looks like this. The graph that goes late at the start, and then they have certain metrics for gains. And they're nuts. Some of the metrics for gains are reduced teenage pregnancy. you know, so some really things you can't get at, reduced juvenile delinquency. But the more important metrics in our community would be things like academic attainment, truancy, which again is not such a big metric for us. But again, we also have a very visible, we're told every morning that we're starting too early. Because the teachers look around the classroom, they can see we're starting too early. So it's many schools, national school systems, don't start as early as we do anyway, so they haven't made changes. Just their systems are already starting at 9 a.m. And then even in the UK, there are certain sixth form colleges, which is just basically grades 11 and 12, they are doing 2 p.m. starts now.
So if we know that it's been proven and it's important, so then why, if I understand it was shelved for 2 years,
yep.
Why would they shelve something that could really help the learning of the kids for so long?
Yeah. Why are we shelving it for 2 years, and why are we shelving something that can really help the kids? We would see this as an incremental improvement. I think ISB is a great school in many respects and is in a very good position. The big mistake is to think we've arrived and we don't have to do anything different. I think the benefits of this will be incremental. I don't think overnight we'll sort of see every single student getting a 45-point diploma. I don't think overnight every student will be doing 8 subjects. But I think all of our students will get an incrementally small benefit, which may be most reflected at the dinner table at night. So many of the benefits of this are very hard to measure. Some of the benefits, as I say, have been measured in academic terms using standardized tests in the States. 2 years is not felt to be a long time. We are hoping that within 2 years, the BTS transport system will give us some options in terms of pick-up points for ferrying kids to school. So we don't think 2 years is too long. We also think that there are some raw nerves right now. There are some people who've been, the process has unavoidably offended some people, and we think that's probably a respectable amount of time before we come back to the table. I'll make this the last 2 questions on this topic. One, two, yeah.
I still have a question. I thought that when we were talking about this, later start, the idea is how to get the kids to be able to sleep longer, and that will improve their study. Mm-hmm. The later start is the school proposal for the solution to that study that we were talking about. Mm-hmm. It might not be the solution that the school should look at. It might be something that probably, you know what I mean? The problem is how can the kid get to sleep longer and how do they have better sleep?
I think what you just said, the second better sleep is the thing. Better sleep, and when their bodies are actually ready to sleep, when their bodies
are ready to sleep. Correct, but the solution the school proposes of getting, starting later, it might not be the solution. So, you mean not the only solution?
It might not be, but I'd like to say that was the focus of that particular initiative. Last question.
Yeah, well, first I want to say thanks. I thought you did a really great job at describing the decision-making process, and it's helped me a lot. And I think with respect to the late start, I've been very happy with that process as far as I've understood it, right until the very end when that decision was made to change it for 2 years. And I might not have the full information, so I defer to those people who are making the decision. That's why we choose our school board. That's why we choose the school that we're coming to, because we put our trust into the administration and the school board. Nevertheless, it seems somehow flawed that we are making a decision that, in my understanding, is driven in part by a minority, so not a majority of the community, and quite clearly goes against the best interests of the students. Shouldn't decisions be made? I mean, you said decisions are that VD blah, 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 learning thing. Should decisions be made really with our students in mind?
Yeah.
And that's where my personal sort of unhappiness comes from.
Yeah.
And I know I'm not actually addressing it to the right people, but this is the forum which I think is fantastic exists, that allows us as parents to voice that unhappiness or concern. And so it's not really a question to you, it's not directed at anyone here, but I feel not only my concern, but what I'm hearing from the parent community as well, is that we're not putting the well-being of our students first by making this decision and by shelving it for 2 years, which in the life of an institution might not be a long time, but in the life of individual students is a long time. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. We have a stenographer here, and we'll
Can I just say one other thing? When you see the states that have done this and done it successfully, it's taken a lot of time, and it's a statewide decision, it's a district decision. You don't get one school saying I'm shifting it, because then it affects all your activity programs and everything. It's a big change. I think also that 2 years allows ISB to discuss with other schools and BSAC about what they're doing. You know, what is NIST doing? What is Patna doing? As a community of international schools, could that be considered? But I think there are some short-term things that we could look at. I mean, I have students in my office who are getting 3 hours sleep, and the wheels are falling off because they're getting 3 hours sleep. That's not got anything to do with a late early start. It's discipline and homework time. It's getting to bed. It's that piece which as parents and the school have to work together. It's a big piece. Speaking of which,
mountains of information and research which clearly states the benefits, as opposed to all this personal input and interpretation.
So the other question that's come up is Haiku. We're wondering, I think the question that has been raised is, you know, why can't parents get access to Haiku? In middle school we had access, why is high school not that case? I think it's really important to state that the learning process as we go from elementary to middle school to high school is all about getting independence. That when your child is a senior and they, you know, walk off the stage and graduate from here, they're about to move on to something where they are on their own at college. And so part of that step is transitioning some of the support structures we have, with Haiku being one of them. In middle school, your parents are invited to be part of the Haiku site to see what your child is learning, and to follow that process. In high school, we don't offer that. So the students have the access to the online classes, and we ask that your student be proactive with yourself. We see it in high school as a teacher-student tool, where the teacher is working sometimes in the class, they're using it. It forms the basis of the curriculum. It's kind of the portal, the online portal that we use for learning, and it's used in the classroom, and it's used for homework. For those people doing the classrooms, it's often used as a link in there. But the idea is that it's where the student and the teacher interact in an online forum. You can still see this. And the question that you need to ask your high school student is, can you show me your Haiku? And what are you learning right now? Can you take me through your high school, your class of chemistry? Can I look at this online? The question that follows then is, obviously, what if they want to show it to you? So that may be more of a difficult question of, I can't get on. Well, actually, they can get on. It may be that they don't know how to get on, which then the follow-up question will be, well, have you worked with your teacher? Most students are using this. So at this stage in the year, if your child's saying, oh, no, I don't use Haiku, I don't think they're telling you the right answer. It could be that they're completely disorganized and they're not sure of the process of using that, and they're not using it well. In that case, I mean, you can ask them if you want for their password and jump on. As a parent, I would probably ask my child for their password. Or I would say, can you at least sit down and go through with me once a week? What have you learned? What's on Haiku at the moment? What assignments have you got coming up? The goal, obviously, as they've come to the junior, senior year, is that at that point, they are independent and they work on that by themselves. And that's our goal as a school, and I think as parents, that's all of our goals as well, that we allow our students to be independent and using that resource. But if your child is really obstinate and saying, no, you can't come on, that's where feel free to drop me an email and I can have a conversation to support you with a conversation with your child as well. Education is a partnership together, and it's more successful in that way. But we don't want the case of parents being on there all the time and overcrowding a child on that. We want that independence forming. So I hope that does make sense there. If you do have issues with any of this, Chris Bell is also a good contact in terms of discussing this further, or come and see myself.
So this sort of is a thorny topic. The topic, we call it instructional supervision. Parents may characterize it in terms of teachers who cause their sons or daughters concerns. We would sort of say, of course, we all have a vested interest in ensuring that the most important resource in the learning process, the teachers, are the best they can be. It's our most important responsibility as administrators to hire and select great teachers. We're just coming to the end of that cycle right now. Next year, we've got, I think, 12 teachers leaving high school, about right, 10 or 12. We've been out there working very hard to get the very, very best teachers coming in. We have teachers, existing teachers, who cause concerns for certain people. And one of the characterizations that, that was put in terms of the principal forum question is, how is it that year after year the administration ignores all the negative feedback about certain teachers? That's the question. So we would say that we don't ignore face-to-face feedback and that we do take that very, very seriously. For example, though, there are certain aspects aspects of the educational environment which are very different from industry. A teacher leaving, say, for example, in June 2016, this, the end of this academic year, could easily have signed their last contract in December 2013. Okay? So right now, teachers are signing contracts in December 2015, which will run till June 2018. So there is anyone in industry, they go, you know, to have a contract that long and that secure is probably a very different, that's an operational norm, that's in no way exceptional in schools. And in many schools, you basically have a contract for life, and the only way you'd lose your job would be if you were egregious in terms of the way you treated students or colleagues by physically hitting them or damaging them. That's not the way it is at ISB, but it is slightly different. So we have mechanisms which allow us to evaluate teachers, but those mechanisms may seem very slow to some people. And these are decisions which are not high school decisions. These are sort of structural decisions for the whole school. The idea also that we have... we are very meticulous when we have face-to-face conversations about a problem. But every day, most problems in the school never come anywhere near us, because most problems in the school are dealt with instantly by the teacher and the student. It's those problems that that persist and go beyond that which fester and create very bad feelings, or make people feel they're not being listened to, or make people feel that the teacher doesn't care about the learning of the student. But as I say, most problems every day are dealt with and we never hear about them. Some problems are dealt with, the student will take it to a head of department or a counsellor, and the counsellor will deal with that problem and have a conversation. And most problems are a complete lack of awareness. The most common conversation you hear is a teacher sort of saying, I had no idea, I'm very glad you told me that. And they're very quickly resolved. I mean, and as I say, that happens, and that happens every day in the class when a kid sticks his hand up and sort of says, sorry, I didn't understand what you said, and that's the right thing to be saying, but some students don't feel the confidence to do that, and sometimes you'll hear that the teacher's very dismissive of that comment. So, all of this filters down, so some problems come to us. Without a doubt, some problems do come to us. And we are meticulous in logging those issues, but to give you an example, because, again, I'm hearing that everyone knows about this problem, and it's all very well talked about. This year to date, and we're half through the year, there are three logged problems in high school. Last year, I went back to look at the records from last year, there were seven logged issues that came as far as the principal's office. And that would be an issue where a parent or a student has come and sat down and had a conversation about a concern. So, straight away, that's probably, I don't know, what do you think about that? That's probably, you're thinking, that can't be true. It can't possibly be true because I know that this is this and that I hear from talking about something and it can't be true. But there's no reason for me not to be honest about that. So then you have the question, why are things sort of underreported? Or why don't we hear about things? Or surely you've seen it yourself. This semester, the three of us will have made nearly 200 classroom visits. And we're doing it every day. I did 5 yesterday. I wrote notes to all the teachers involved. 4 of those notes were very positive. 1 of those notes was very questioning. I went to a classroom yesterday where I had a lot of questions at the end of that visit. And the teacher wrote back a very understandable answer, but we now have a conversation going. Now, it's not a parent concern, that's not a student concern, that's, you know, an instructional supervision observation. I'm not even saying it's a concern, I'm just saying that we want to have these honest conversations. We hear that people are afraid to report concerns in case there's some form of reprisal. I guess that's why we have an anonymous principal forum. Because even adults feel there could be some form of reprisal.
I would just like to touch on that. And that is a perception the student body has too, which I find very strange, because I agree with you. I don't see there is a need for that. But if you talk to students, or when they talk about things, they will, and I will, as a parent, say to them, well, you need to go and talk. If you feel you can't talk to your teacher, you need to talk to somebody else. Most of the time, the students will say, oh, no. They will find out, and I'll have a problem, and that kind of thing. So I don't really know how you will deal with that as administration.
One way we deal with... The question was essentially that as a parent, as someone having a conversation with their kid, encouraging to talk to a teacher, and the kid is saying back to mum, I don't want to do that because there'll be some form of negativity that in the air. Again, if that's the way someone feels, that's the way they feel. But it still doesn't mean you can't come to us. So we will visit classrooms where we visit a lot of classrooms, but we'll get told things that we're unaware of. Then we'll go and visit classrooms targeted purposefully. We'll often have a conversation with the teacher and sort of say, you're not going to like this conversation, and I think you're going to be surprised, but someone is characterizing your behavior as you're putting kids down when you say these sorts of things. And most of the time, they'll say, great, that's exactly what I wanted. No, they're shocked. Because our teachers genuinely understand that the most important thing is their relationship with the kids before their knowledge. They get that. And they get that not least because we say that all the time. We say, they don't care what you know, so they know you care. And our best teachers are constantly being grabbed and mauled by the students because they are so receptive to the students' needs.
I hope I'm not one of your 3 lots in the current this semester. The question is, I think from the parent point of view, how far do we have to go? If the kids already discussed with the teacher, if the kids already discussed with the counselor, and we've gone to one of you, and we still don't hear anything, how far do we have, what else as a parent?
So if you come to my office as a parent, the high school principal, he's very clever, isn't he? He always says the right things, and you go away and you feel happy. Or maybe you don't, because you've heard it before. I don't think you have heard it before. So you come to the principal, and I'll tell you that what I will follow up. The follow-up will typically be very confidential. We've had follow-ups, and I'm looking at, and we've had turnarounds. We have had absolute turnarounds in terms of... In the last 7 years, we've had turnarounds in teachers who've become aware of something. And it's nearly always, it's never they become aware that they didn't know their physics or they didn't know their math. Our teachers know their stuff. It's always about the way they're interacting with the kids, the way they make the kids feel. And we've had, even sometimes, this happens to us, being late to a lesson habitually as a teacher. You could be a great teacher, but if you're late to the lesson, or the last thing you do before a lesson starts is go and get a cup of coffee so you come 5 minutes late, that's not a great message. But that's a very easily addressed conversation. Again, teachers don't like the principal talking to them about those sorts of things, but if it's attendance and punctuality, that makes a difference. If it's the way that they handle questions, that makes a difference. So we have people who turn around. We have people who don't. And we have a process that, as I said from the very beginning, it may seem very slow, but again, someone talked about the organizational speed and the individual speed. Yeah, as an individual, these things can be too slow, but as an organization over the last few years, we have definitely done a lot to improve the quality of the teaching by improving teachers, and by for teachers who are not a great fit or a great match, they've gone elsewhere to look for better matches.
But how much do you take into account these parent or criticism that teacher is? I'm familiar with the teacher that since I've been here, the people in his class have complained, the students have complained at parent conferences. Teacher is very condescending to the parents and stuff. There's been many complaints. I know the contract with him has expired and been renewed. So as a parent, I would think it really doesn't matter what we tell you or how many times we tell you or how many of us tell you, that it doesn't really affect, because this teacher obviously maybe knows the subject matter, but that quote, they'll never forget how they make those students feel. And every one of those, not everyone, but many of those students come out feeling low.
There is going to be examples like that. As I say, if you hold of the organization, I don't know what to say, then things are changing and
security and of how you communicate back to the parent after the
I think the way we communicate back can happen, but ultimately the parent will sort of say, yeah, but I'm not, it doesn't matter what you say, it's what my kid says that's the important communication. I'd say we can't sort of talk about individuals. Next year our rosters will look different to this year. And we're always doing that very much with getting the best possible teachers. And again, sometimes you get very contradictory messages. I mean, and we look for patterns. We look for patterns of concerns. And sometimes we get really contradictory messages about an individual. You know, some people will love somebody, and other people just... Sorry.
Could you possibly feel there might be some cultural differences that are not understood by the kids? Maybe the action could improve?
Well, that's an interesting observation, the idea that sometimes there are cultural differences. Some teachers come from schooling systems where they've been very successful, and we would always hire people who've been previously successful, because that's one of our key indicators. It's not how well they interview, it's how their principals describe them. They've been very successful, and yet they come here, and culturally, that put-down attitude can be... I don't think a put-down attitude is ever humorous, but for some people it can be less intimidating or less... I know what you're saying, and you're correct. Sometimes it's a cultural aspect, but we expect people to assimilate to our culture. We expect students to assimilate to our culture. We expect teachers to assimilate to our culture, because that's who we say we are. Sorry, you had a question?
Yeah, I have a quick question. As you can tell, I'm a process person. So, you know, what you've been talking about is, you know, how we can address individual problems in terms of coming to you, et cetera, but I think for me as a parent, what would be helpful, and this might not be the time right now, maybe it would be the next principal forum, would be get to an understanding of the process of performance monitoring that goes on for the teachers. So who's involved in that process monitoring? What is the structure of it? How often does it take place? Is it just the feedback that comes from you and your team who go into the classrooms? Are students involved in that? To what extent do parent comments feed in?
I can very quickly give you a quick rundown of the process, and some of you have heard this before. We've already described we make over 200 visits this semester. They're all unannounced. Okay, so some schools will have formal announced visits. We don't do any announcing of our visits because, again, we're not... And again, we go to classrooms and we don't... Our focus is not to look at teacher behaviours. Okay, and then you're going to say, why on earth would that be? Our focus is to listen to students talk about their learning. Because a teacher behaviour... The minute we walk into a classroom, we're told, sometimes, occasionally, teacher behaviours change. Inconceivable, but anyway. But the way a kid can articulate their learning never changes. So if I say to a kid, and this is one of my favourite questions, If your friend was, I say, if your friend was away today, have they missed much? And you say to me, oh yeah, we've done tons. Or they say, no, we've done, you know, that's a really revealing question. You know, just sort of say to kids, how much has been missed today? Because a teacher can make the classroom look busy for 80 minutes. And I can walk in there and see the teacher busying for 80 minutes. I can talk to a kid for 2 minutes and sort of say, if she wasn't here today, how much work has she missed today? And they can give me, and they can answer that, and they will answer that without knowing the intent of that question. A lot of these questions, we also talk to kids. I have an office, and it's right by what I call the fishbowl. It's the noisiest place in the world. And the kids sitting on tables all day long, I have to talk to students about where have you come from, what were you doing? I'm not even in the classroom, but again, I want to talk to kids, and we want to talk to kids about the learning experience. Now, that's not to say that we don't observe teacher behaviours, because teacher behaviours either help or hinder the learning experience. So, observations, student feedback. Okay, every student in most courses, every year or every 2 years, will be giving an anonymous student feedback. Every student tells us it's not really anonymous. It's anonymous, okay? But every student will tell us, oh, you can find out who it is. And that feedback is scored against, there's a lot of it's numbers scored. And again, we then compare number scores from teacher to teacher. Because, I mean, what does it mean if 80% of students say they feel comfortable asking a teacher for help if they're stuck? 80%, that's pretty good. It's not pretty good if in all the other classes it's 95% of students. And that's what you'd hope, actually, somewhere in the high 90s, you know, because there's always only one or two students. So we do these, and we put those comparisons again beside teachers. We do formal observations where we have a checklist of things we're looking for with our new teachers. We pick up patterns from conversations with students. Am I missing something, Phil?
Yeah, we also would have sit-down conversations with teachers that last longer and create targeted goals for them. So if we've got a concern with a teacher and we've been in a few times and we're like, okay, this is, we've now cross-referenced, yes, there's a concern here. We'll then create meetings with that teacher, and it's probably just one of us doing that meeting to start with and saying, what goals are we going to set for you and where are we going to help you move forward? What support do we need to give in terms of PD to help them turn around? But also, what measures are we going to say that, okay, here's the goal, but how are we going to measure your success against that goal to move forward?
And at that point, we actually have a set of about 40 standards, teacher standards, which we don't normally put out, but we put those out as a prescription for a targeted improvement. And it's a standard with a description, and we'll put it against it and say, this is where you need to move on this rubric. Teachers have rubrics as well. So all of that is what happens, but it still doesn't mean the concerns you're raising are not valid.
Phil, to put this into some sort of quantifiable measure, of the 220 or 250 odd staff, would you say that 10% are concerned, 5%, 2%? Because to me, talking to the room, I'm concerned that parents will go away and think there's a lot of concern with a lot of teachers.
I think most parents would say that most of their kids' teachers have really meet the needs of their sons and daughters very well. I think probably every parent, I'd say every parent knows of a teacher. They've heard things about it. That's the other thing. Sometimes you haven't even had the teacher and you've already heard that you're going to be spending vast amounts of money on therapy for someone who has that teacher. You know, and these rumours, perpetuate and sometimes they're not fair because they have been addressed and they have changed, but it's the nature of our community.
So can you quantify?
I would say that there are 80 odd teachers in high school. At any one time, we're perhaps having a conversation with there are 80 teachers.
80
teachers in high school at any one time. And again, it's not negative to have a conversation. I mean, yesterday I had a conversation, as I said, but it was an email conversation to start with about an observation. It's an observation I made which left me wondering. Because if I was wondering, anyone else could be wondering. And sometimes that just is enough as well. Okay, our last question on this topic.
I just want, because the kids want to reach the goal, the teacher wants to reach the goal, and I've been told that the activity after school activities start 3 o'clock for high schoolers, so they can talk to the teacher after school.
Yes.
But which day, I don't understand, because I have a student that goes to this teacher and is never ever there after school. So is there a certain days? Does the teacher decide which day? How does it work? What's
I don't mind hearing that. that's definitely a conversation. I mean, I would really want to talk to your son and daughter personally about that, because that time from lessons ending at about 2:05 to 3:00 is time is the time. There are teachers who can have commitments and be busy.
Yeah, I know.
That's normally very structured, it's normally very predictable. So if your son or daughter is repeatedly unable to meet somebody, that's a concern. And I really want to know a bit more about that. Not here, but definitely. Okay, I'm going to click the button. What is this next one? Oh, yes, it's a good topic. So the question was really very specific. And it was born out of a concern, I think, that there are a lot of students dropping out of math programs, which is an indication they're not very well prepared for math programs. Which means they're not going to reach their mathematical potential. So there was a question which was, over the last 7 years, can you tell me exactly how many students have dropped out of grade 9 and 10 math programs, because that would be, or dropped down in grade 9 and 10 math programs, because that's a piece of information that would be very useful. No, we can't, not least because for most of the last 7 years, there's been no chance to drop up or down out of a 9 and 10 math program because it's been very programmed. Algebra 1, geometry, algebra 2, trig. There's no dropping up or down. You're in that program. So that's one of the reasons why that number, that specific number, wouldn't be very helpful. Now we have a situation though where we are running math programs which are at different speeds, for want of a better word, or difficult. So we have our 9 and 10 math programs now reflect the IB math programs in 11 and 12, and that there's a higher, there's a standard, there's a study sort of track. So what you can have then is somebody in the higher track going to the standard track, or somebody in the standard track going to the studies track. Now I'll give you some specific numbers in a minute, but the big picture numbers are these. These are the big picture numbers, and over the last 5 years, not 7 years, this is our entry for math higher level. The numbers, this is an anomaly, but the numbers have been fairly constant. And that's what you'd expect in a high school. There's normally about a class of people who want to do math higher level. That number, the percent has gone down largely because so many more students are now doing IB courses. If you look at IB math, if you look here, this has gone up. Okay. Now, you might say, well, if this has gone up, why hasn't this gone up? Because these kids were always doing the hardest high-level math. During this time, these numbers have also not fluctuated a great deal. This is probably... I'd say this is probably the most important indicator for us. This is very hard math, and it's a very competitive math if you want to present yourself to a university track that's looking for hard math. Hard math's not a great word, I know. There's a mathematician. So this is if you want to do engineering in most competitive colleges or a science-based program or economics, this would be your normal track.
Yeah.
This would be your hyper-competitive London School of Economics, for example, some of the Ivy Leagues, but not really.
Actuarial studies, yeah. some high-level engineering courses.
So we're pretty happy with this tracking. If this was, if this was 30%, we'd be worried. If this was 5%, we'd be worried. Or if this was dropping dramatically, this one's not going to drop dramatically because that's always been about the right level. So then the question is, how many kids are dropping? The numbers for that would be, so we have about 42 math programs. We don't have 42 math programs, we have 42 math classes.
It's a lot of programs, Mr. Bradley.
I heard a snort from the slide. So we have about 42 math classes. 10 of those classes would probably be, going back to the last slide, catering to the kids who are on the studies track. So 30 out of those classes are, they have an option to go down. And of those 30 classes, we were looking at this, it's about one or two kids in a class may drop down. Okay? Now, the reasons they drop down are interesting. This is probably our single biggest reason a kid drops down, is that at the very start, there was a parental override. In other words, the student was recommended for a course, and the parent and the student said, no, we want to do this course. That's our single biggest drop down. And we'll always support these students, because if they want to take the challenge, that's fine. I mean, sometimes it's almost not fine, but ultimately, you know, there is something to be learned from having a go at something and struggling. This is another kind of, sometimes kids arriving at ISB, so these placements are much easier to make if a student's been at ISB for 3 or 4 years, or the year before. But sometimes we have, we give students arriving at ISB the benefit of the doubt, and they get placed with the benefit of the doubt, a bit more generous, and they drop down.
It's come back.
Sometimes, the third category, this is the one that stings and hurts. Sometimes a kid who's been really working very hard, typically a really hard-working student, gets into a math course and they hit the wall, and they don't perform, or they don't continue to perform as they had hoped or as they had been doing, and there are very few of these students. And this is another category, what we call the reverse override, which is people sort of saying, yeah, my kid's handling this course fine, the teacher's happy, but they're not getting an A. Or they're not getting a B+. So if they go down, they'll get an A. And of course that will boost your GPA. And we will say, and that's not the most important thing, and they'll say, that's the most important thing. And again, sometimes a kid in the diploma program could choose 6 higher levels. And they just decide not to choose math higher level. And that's, but that's not typically a move down. But sometimes kids in program will sort of say, I can get a higher grade if I go here. This is the biggest, this is the smallest, and then we have this either side. I don't know whether that still leaves anxiety up.
You were saying your totals were higher, which you thought was good, and that's assuming then, like what I'm wondering is, does everybody have to take an IB math? Is there a math that's below IB? Because you guys have a biology, chemistry, physics that aren't IB. Do you have that for math?
This year we didn't have it because we didn't have enough numbers in it. There was a course that wasn't below; it was an equivalent course.
Yeah, but you know what I mean.
But we are looking at that for next year again. We're looking to try and design a course that will be more appropriate for kids who find this a real challenge, because we are getting more kids who are finding their maths a challenge. So we've sat down with the maths department and they're looking at saying, okay, well, can we design a course that's more appropriate for those students? And we're doing that. We've certainly done it in grades 9 and 10 already. And that's one of the reasons that we've got a separate course for those who really find maths a challenge. So we've started down that track, and we'll continue to investigate that track and see what numbers we get when we put that out there in the program of studies this year. They're both in the same direction.
Can I just suggest that there's a group think among students to some extent, because I have a son that's in this category, the notion that why am I working so hard in this course when my friends are finding it easy in the course below? And oh, by the way, two of my friends just dropped to the course below and now they're really loving it, so boy, this just got too hard for me. I think I'll go down too. And maybe there's a way to stop that mentality in the school, but that's the mentality that was at my kitchen table, so I just pass that along.
There is a way, I think, we do ourselves a disservice because so many of our structures support that thinking. The GPA structure, the high honor roll structure, these things, which, you know, we're not getting everything tomorrow, by the way, I want to have a nice Christmas holiday. but those things are almost a mixed message when you're saying to kids, do your best, and the harder you can do something, the better it is for you. Then you have these mixed messages where we have mechanisms that say, by the way, you won't be on the honor roll now. So, yeah. Yeah.
Challenge.
Yeah.
Sorry, Terry.
How many students are required to make class? Because, like, that class that you took away this year, that could have been a lot of people.
Yeah.
It would have been very good for them.
Yep.
At the time, it was somewhere between 3 and 5 kids were applying to do that class, so it wasn't sufficient. When we looked at our big overall picture and said, okay, we've got this many classes to provide, we've got this many students in every program, we're hoping that with the new courses, we're going to target a specific group that we think we will have enough numbers for them to go yes.
It was less than 5 at the time we pulled it.
Yes. No question. Okay, so what I'm hearing and I'm hoping that I'm right about this, but at the end of the year, when the teachers are telling the students what class they should be in next year, in my experience in the last couple of years, what's happening is the kids are told, these are the IB courses you need to take. You've got to be in this class, go ahead and take standard level math. You're going to do just fine. You know it's going to be hard, but you're ready for it. And then these kids, none of those kids knew about the other options, so they didn't know that they could sign up for that other non-IB course. So they all signed up for the standard level course. And I have a feeling in my experience, those kids were more in the third category here. Not the first category, a lot of kids dropped down from standard level to math studies who could have benefited from that other class. And I just think that from what I know of what happened in my kid's year, she's in the third category, and there's a lot of kids that I've heard about in that category. So I'm surprised when you say that there's not that many.
It's not, I'm just saying in rank order, it's not as big as this. It's the smallest in rank order.
We need to get better at our communication if the kids weren't aware that those courses were on offer, because it had been on offer for the last 5 years before that. So it wasn't as if it wasn't out there as an option. So we can get better at our communication and improve on that for the kids to give them those options and those choices.
We should probably move on.
I'm just wondering the time. It's 10:35. We do a couple of quicker ones. We don't want to hold people if you're desperate to jump out and get into the traffic.
Okay, this one is a shorter one. This has come up. Can ISB consider a boarding arrangement? Is there a need for this? Yes, there is a need. We see students are living downtown. They're traveling a long time. It could be staying overnight for a single night. It could be staying from Monday to Friday boarding. Some families, search internationally for international schools and send their kids to a boarding school full time. We've all worked in schools which have boarding facilities within the international school setting and within a home country setting. It offers a huge amount of benefits, but it is a direction the school hasn't chosen to go yet. There definitely is a need for it. Could ISB meet the need? Right now it's not on any strategic learning plan. It's something which we will raise to the head of school and say, this has been raised in the principal's forum. The other one is, you know, what else could happen? This currently happens informally, where some of you, I'm sure, have housed other students that live downtown. They've got, you know, a night here where there's a movie night and not getting up to 9 o'clock, and so they stay at your place the night. So there's a lot of that informally just occurring with, you know, sports teams, and they're going on a Friday night and they're playing Saturday morning, so come stay at our house. There's models we've all seen where there are, you know, private companies that set up boarding arrangements. I've worked in a school where we paired with a private company that arranged housing in homes and parents are paid. But that's obviously outside the school, but you know, that kind of thing is a possibility that we consider. It needs to fall in line with our guardianship agreement that we have. But could it be a benefit? Yes, it could. At the moment, no, it's not on a strategic learning plan. It is a big endeavour. It's a big shift from what we are right now as a school, but it could add a lot of value. So.
I think the next question relates to me. One of the questions was the ACT, could it be offered during the December break? We don't get to determine the dates of the ACT and the SAT. They are determined by the boards that run those ones. We are running an ACT this Saturday. Actually, tomorrow there will be kids in this room sitting there ACT. But if you're interested in the dates, and they're not exactly the same dates as those offered in the US, internationally they only offer certain dates that are offered in the US. That's not our determination. That's the same with the SAT. For those of you who've got kids in sophomore or junior year that might be waiting for the new revised, the redesigned SAT, they are not offering that for us as an international school until May, whereas in the US they're offering it in March. So we don't get to determine those things, unfortunately. It would be nice, because as someone said, you can place it where there's less workload for kids, but we don't get to make that determination. This is it for 2016-17. They've already released those dates for the international schools.
So, yep. Every test day, ISB is a test center for ACT, right?
We are a test center for ACT.
Every testing day.
Yeah. If we get kids sign up, yes, we take them. So if we don't get any kids sign up, then obviously we won't run the test on that day.
Okay. And these are always on the school calendar.
Yeah, they're on the calendar.
Very soon for next year.
Yeah. So. Because I think there was a thought that it wasn't running tomorrow, but there isn't. The ACT is running tomorrow. Why is the redesigned PSAT for grade 11 only at ISB? So we're of the opinion that we don't want to over-assess our students. And some of our students can have assessment overload, where it's like, I just have another test, and sometimes it's this standardised and that standardised. So in grade 10... we provide our students with the ISA, which is the International Schools Assessment, which provides a guide for how they're going in terms of international standards. Previously, we did offer the Grade 10 PSAT on a different day. The alternate day is not a school day. It's a Saturday, and we received very low sign-up for that. It was a Saturday, and I think we had 2 students sign up. So there was actually, it didn't make any sense to continue to run that. Another question that was raised was, the PSAT relates to the National Merit Scholarship. I'd like my child to practice. There are plenty of online opportunities for students to practice those tests and get those experiences of what type of question might come up if they're looking to do that in terms of applying for a National Merit Scholarship. Okay. And I think there's one more. There was a question about, and it was a very, very specific question about non-US university advising. You've hopefully seen that site, which when this question came up wasn't there. This site is now there on the school website, which provides access for many, many countries and what are the requirements to get into different universities and different links through the counsellors. But the question came up, it was regarding an Australian university, and I happened to be right involved in this because I was the one in Australia at the time with the parent, working with that parent and that student. So the concern was that when the students signed up for where their results went to, they signed up that those results would go directly to the university. Now, I don't know whether you know a lot about Australia, but Australia's in the Southern Hemisphere. So we work on a different university schedule. Our universities start in February and finish in December. So this student was actually applying for a mid-year entry, which is a little different to normal. And the student applied to the university thinking, oh, I'll send my results directly to that university, and it will be fine. Well, in fact, that wasn't the case. So within about 3 hours, I was on the phone working with that parent and that student to say, okay, go to the university, explain what you've done, they'll tell you, go and do this. And we worked out that I actually needed to go to the university admission centre, and we managed to have those results there within 24 hours for that particular student, and all worked out really nicely. She started 2 weeks later at the university. So it wasn't an issue in that sense. I know that there are concerns, you know, what happens after the 6th of July. If you're not sure why, I've mentioned the 6th of July, that's when the results come out for the kids from the IB. All over the world, it's the same dates, the same time. It all comes out in terms of results come out. Students then have questions. I've got into that university, what does that mean? No, I haven't got into that university, what do I do? And between the counsellors and myself and Mr. Bradley and Mr. Vaught, we're all available. We're online in different parts of the world. Sometimes the kids have to wait 6 hours for me to wake up because I'm on a different time zone. But up they wake and they'll send an email. We're generally on emails for about a week afterwards, answering questions. It might be that they want to remark on their exam or something like that, and we will support them in those processes. It doesn't work perfectly, particularly if you've got a counsellor who's flying from one side of the world to the other during that time and they're offline for 24, 48 hours, but we can always utilise each other wherever we are in the world. So we are in different places, but we do support our kids in that way. And with 180 kids graduating each year, applying to multiple different universities in multiple countries, it sometimes does take a bit of connecting the dots together and saying, okay, how can we help you and what can we do there to support that particular student as they work through any concerns they might have. Some of them, it's a straight easy yes, they're in, no problems, everything worked out how they wanted to.
My concern with that issue, was that the form was signed off by the student incorrectly. They'd signed off something incorrectly, and there wasn't a checking, or the checking system that was in place also failed. And I guess for those of us who come from countries other than the US and Europe, where there's not so many students applying to those countries for university, we perhaps know our own situation, equally well as the counsellors. And I would recommend that the parents get to see that form at that stage.
I can add a parent signature onto that form.
That's
not a problem. The kids will have to hand it in to me. At the moment, we collect it electronically. And the reason we do that is because that data needs to be transferred onto the IB website. And so we could do it an electronic sign-off or something? And that comes in on a Google form. Kids will fill in, because we probably get about 300 different requests, so it's not one or two requests. This one was particularly interesting because it was a Southern Hemisphere, not applying into normal regular entry like a UCAS or something like that, because it's not a normal entry point for Australians to go to university in June. So we can think about that and see if we can come up with a process. Some students don't think they want to send their results, so I get regularly in October, they go, oh, actually, I could be applying for credit because of my result in my IB subject. And they'll come back to me and I'll say, actually, once you went past, it's generally there are certain deadlines for certain countries, but generally it's the 1st of May. If you don't apply to have your results sent, I can't do much about that. You have to go to the IB, and they have a very quick, easy way of applying to have your results sent to university. It costs, I think it's $14 at the moment, or might be $17 to have your results sent directly to a university. In this case, this is a central sorting centre for all the universities in New South Wales and Australia. So we can certainly look at those things. There's quite a large number. And some students go, no, it doesn't matter, and then they'll come back later and say, oh, yes, it did matter. I didn't realise my university was going to give me credit or something like that.
I just think it's a very important form, potentially, for it to go wrong. And so an extra checking from parents who know the system in their own country.
Yeah.
It's probably a good idea.
Thank you very much. We've turned the winter simulator off. There's no getting tropical.
So, one last one from me. FCD came to the presentation, so I had some parents asking for extra information and comparisons between other international schools. In the e-news today, I've shared all that information. FCD have done that for us and compared us to other international schools in Southeast Asia and worldwide international schools. It's in the e-news if you're interested in that.
Thank you all very much. Have a great
break. Have a wonderful Christmas break.
I'd like to thank you for your ongoing support.
Go.
Yeah, we got it.
Get out.
Did you really
want to take
that back
to your
house?
Sorry?
A lot of parents have a question
about
that.
You need to take them to the right restaurant.
You know,
maybe
we just took a long time. But
as I said to Helen when I ran into her this morning, he was a turn up to you.
right? So we're looking to type in the same viewer, but he's a good guy. And
we don't enjoy that.
He's not a over the top guy. So I mean, we're going to renovate his house. But you know what? He's absolutely
yeah, I mean, it's ridiculous. We have this ridiculous vision, you know, for the community, which is a nice thing. Some other tour, they won't even let them bus out. I mean, that's true. I think everybody's glad to have a car in the bus. I mean, it's really delicious.
Yeah, can you just explain it to me? This is actually personal.
This is
our continuous.
Yeah, I saw it.